You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Talking St. Louis Cardinals baseball here from the winter meetings. Tim McMaster along with our MLB.com Cardinals reporter Jennifer Langosch. And Jennifer, the Cardinals are obviously one of those teams that I think all baseball organizations kind of look to as one of those great franchises. How do they generally, John Mozeliak and company, approach the winter meetings?
Yeah, I mean, they like to get their work done quickly. So I think what we've seen in recent years under Mo is that typically by the Christmas holiday, this team is done with its shopping. So that lends itself to a lot of activity in the winter meetings. Now, they're usually not the team making the biggest splashes or holding the biggest press conferences. Last year, you know, they came to the winter meetings looking to re-sign Jason Hayward. Obviously, that fell through. They did kind of do some other things. But I would expect this team, it's been looking for an outfielder since the season ended 2 months ago. They are still in that outfield market, and I think that's going to pick up some traction here.
There's obviously different options out there, but one that you keep hearing about is Dexter Fowler. You mentioned Jason Hayward. He went from the Cardinals to the Cubs, and then John Lackey went from the Cardinals to the Cubs. Beyond a need for an outfielder and the fact that he's maybe the best one available, it would be bringing a Cub to the Cardinals. Does that make it extra sweet?
Maybe for the fans. I mean, it was a sour offseason last year. I mean, you know, a lot of people wanting, obviously the Cardinals included, wanting Jason Hayward to come back. But then the fact that he went to Chicago is kind of an extra little drill in the ribs of sorts. But, yeah, I mean, you look at the free agent market, the Cardinals are looking for a center fielder. They are looking for somebody defensively sound in center field. Your options are basically Dexter Fowler. So I know the Cardinals are interested. I know other teams are as well, which is also why the Cardinals have their fingers in the trade market. Perhaps they're able to find a better fit there. I think the concern with Dexter Fowler is how many years does he want in a contract and how much money annually is that going to require. Now, the good thing for the Cardinals, and we saw it last year, the money they dangled at Jason Hayward, the money they dangled at David Price, neither of whom accepted those offers, they've got that money still. So this is a team that, if they want to, can make a big splash.
Yeah, when they didn't get those guys, they didn't go out and just spend the money. They needed to be smart. They stayed smart. When you talk about Fowler, the question is, you look two years back, and he wasn't what he is now. Is that part of the discussion? How much was last year an outlier, or is that the Dexter Fowler we would have for 4 years?
Yeah, I think that is the concern. I mean, you know, Dexter this past year played deeper, and it was very intentional on the Cubs' part to play him deeper, and we saw the defensive metrics turn more positive for him as a result. But you're right. Throughout his career, he has not been known as a defensively above-average center fielder. I think, too, the fact that if you come to Busch Stadium, it's a bigger center field than you get at Wrigley Field. I think that goes into the equation. So I think for the Cardinals, it's going to be really what is the priority. Do you want a capable center fielder who can also be a leadoff guy? If so, Dexter Fowler is a really good fit. Matt Carpenter then can slide down into a run production spot. If you, however, are very invested in getting a defensively above average center fielder, I think perhaps there's some options on the trade market that might fit this club a little bit better.
Ironically, when you look at Fowler and Hayward a year ago, Fowler was the better player.
They
miss out on Hayward. Maybe they get a better player in the long run and for a shorter term. We've also heard talk of Justin Turner, and it sounded like the Dodgers really want to keep Justin Turner, which to me makes it hard to believe the Cardinals would be able to go get him when you think about budgets and what the Dodgers could spend versus the Cardinals. Plus, there's not a definite need there, right, as far as the Cardinals go?
Yeah, I mean, you look right now at third base, the Cardinals have Johnny Peralta coming back. They have Jed Jerko, who was actually led this team in home runs last year, coming back, and both of those guys kind of profile as fitting at third base. So they do have options. I think Justin Turner is a wild card for this reason, though, and that's the Cardinals, in losing Matt Holliday and in losing Brandon Moss, lost some thump from the middle of the lineup. Yeah. And I think to get a guy like Justin Turner that could be a middle-of-the-order hitter right away, kind of that feared hitter that Matt Holliday was for so many years, I think that could be a boost offensively. You also look, again, this is a team that last year lagged defensively in many ways. You get Justin Turner, he is a defensive upgrade over both Johnny Peralta and Jed Jerko. I think he makes it a little bit better for Aledmys Diaz on the left side of the infield. So again, I mean, you mentioned if they're competing against the Dodgers and who knows who else, the money might end up being a little out of the Cardinals' comfort zone. They do have the money to spend. They're just very judicious in how they dole it out, and we've seen that in their spending in recent years.
Matt Holliday is heading to New York to play for the Yankees, and it was a neat moment at the end of the season when he kind of said goodbye to Cardinals fans, and the way they treated it, I thought, was done really well. How much is this team going to miss Matt Holliday? Not necessarily on the field, but in the clubhouse.
Yeah, they're going to miss him immensely, perhaps more than they realize. And you know, the last 2 years of Matt Holliday's career, he's had trouble both staying on the field and then producing to the level we were used to seeing. But I think the one thing that was very unique on the field about Matt Holliday these last 7+ years is that he lived up to the contract he signed. And how rare is it that we talk about at the end of a 7-year, $120 million contract that a player actually exceeded that value? So, you know, it was a win-win situation. You look at what Matt Holliday has done in the community of St. Louis, I don't think it's talked about enough, the impact that he has had, the hospital visits, the impact with the children in the community, and then within the clubhouse. I mean, he was one of the core leaders in this organization. So that's a hole, not just from a playing standpoint that needs to be filled, but it's one of the reasons why the Cardinals the last couple years have tried to groom kind of a new group of leaders for when Matt Holliday leaves, as he now has, and then Adam Wainwright and Yadi Molina behind him, that they have another generation to kind of take on that Cardinal way.
You mentioned the Cards making their moves early, and Brett Cecil was an early move. 4 years for a reliever, a little surprising, but he's a guy that can be dominant. And then they trade away Jaime Garcia, which I think when they re-upped or took Jaime Garcia in for another year, the plan all along seems like it was to trade him, to lock him in so that they could trade him. It works out. They didn't get top-end prospects, but it seems like you get depth in your minor league system for a guy that's breaking down maybe a little bit.
Yeah, they got something.
Yes.
And that was really the key for the Cardinals. I mean, with the option, I think there were a lot of fans that wondered, why in the world would the Cardinals pick up an option on a guy who struggled? I mean, he had 30 starts last year, only 10 of those quality starts. I mean, very poor numbers. The fact that the free agent market is so thin in starting pitching this year, the Cardinals knew they had an asset, and they were able to flip that, as you mentioned, for three minor leaguers. You know, John Gant might be a guy that right away can help out in the bullpen or certainly allow for some starting pitching depth for the Cardinals. So it made a lot of sense. The Cardinals felt that if they had an asset, let's try to flip it for what we can. I think now moving forward, though, that he's not in the mix, the Cardinals will be very hesitant to deal any more starting pitching. They know the importance of having that depth. They've seen it a year ago with Lance Lynn going out, in the past with Adam Wainwright going down with injuries. So they want to have those 6 or 7 starters, which they have right now. And again, in a market very thin with starting pitching, perhaps a little bit rare that they have so many.
They have all those arms. It'll be interesting to see what they all end up doing. Lance Lynn will be back. That's good to see. But Michael Wacha is a guy that you hear about. Maybe he becomes a bullpen guy. Trevor Rosenthal's been the closer, but he lost that job last year. How do you see it kind of shaking out with these still fairly young arms, especially Wacha, not maybe fitting the role that we anticipated a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I think Wacha is a very interesting case, and he went home this winter with a different workout regimen to really try to strengthen his shoulder. We know that he's now had 2 shoulder injuries, the same injury recurring twice in 3 years, and that's a long-term concern for the Cardinals, and they're not sure if this is a guy that down the road can throw 200 innings in a season. So he'll have an opportunity right now to compete for a rotation spot. If he doesn't win that, especially as we've seen the bullpen evolution that we did, particularly in the postseason, the Cardinals look at Michael Wacha as perhaps that bridge guy that could be very valuable, maybe used in shorter stints. Trevor Rosenthal, an interesting case in that the Cardinals are going to stretch him out, not necessarily to make him a starter per se, but to maybe allow for a little bit, again, more flexibility in that bullpen. So 2 guys coming off disappointing years who went home with motivation to get better. And as you mentioned, still very young. I think we forget how young they were because they came up so early and had that success. But guys that the Cardinals still believe are part of their future.
Maybe the key to this team is how guys bounce back, right? Because there's not a lot of areas where you can drastically improve this team. They missed the playoffs for the first time in a long time, and that's not something this team expects to do. And I know the goal in 2017 is to get back there. So it's a matter of guys already on this roster playing better than they did, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think also improving the defense will in turn improve your starting pitching. I mean, that was, I think, really the surprise to a lot of us this year, was how poor the pitching results were from a group that a year before has historically good ERA. So I think if you improve the defense, you're improving your pitching. As you mentioned, some of these younger players taking step forwards, and even some of the older players even just performing maybe to their career averages that they didn't a year ago. And staying healthy. I mean, that was an issue for this team this year, staying healthy and not having the depth behind it. If they can stay healthier, it's a big gap, 17.5 games that they finished behind the Cubs to close. But as we've seen, you don't always have to win your division. If you can get into October, you can still do special things.
This has been MLB.com Extras, our Cardinals Winter Meetings Edition. For Jennifer Langosh, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. We are talking Pittsburgh Pirates baseball here at the Winter Meetings. Tim McMaster along with our MLB.com Pirates reporter Adam Berry. And the Pirates obviously in all the rumors here at the winter meetings because of Andrew McCutchen. And will they not trade him? There's so much smoke around this story. It seemed like it was really close with the Nationals. But are we getting to the point where you almost have to deal him because they've been talking about it so much?
I don't think so. This is something the Pirates have dealt with quite a bit. You look back even to last offseason with Mark Melancon. There was a lot of trade talk about him over the winter. They opened the season with him, wound up dealing him at the trade deadline, of course, but these guys are professionals. They know how to handle the situation. McCutchen was the subject of extension and trade rumors last offseason, so it's nothing he hasn't been through before.
There's other teams besides the Nationals, obviously, and that's what you want. So when the Pirates, when you look at the type of package they could get back, do you have any thoughts on the type of thing they're looking at that's going to get them to really be interested?
From my understanding, specifically they're looking for a young, contractually controlled starting pitching, you know, a young major leaguer who they can plug into the rotation behind Gerrit Cole and Jameson Taillon, number three type of starter to eat up some innings, be under club control for a while. And then they would really like a top prospect. I think the talks with the Nationals about Victor Robles and somebody like Lucas Giolito or Ronaldo Lopez, those are pretty interesting kind of templates to look for when you're talking about a potential Andrew McCutchen trade.
Now, when you're talking about the Nationals, is it going to take all three of them? I mean, are they looking for Giolito, Lopez, and Robles?
I think it would be Robles and one of the pitchers. Okay. I think that's probably a good place to start. They'll probably ask for a third player because why not? It's Andrew McCutchen, shoot for the moon. And my understanding is the Pirates are drawing a pretty hard line. If they don't get exactly what they want, they're not going to trade him because, as they've repeated from day one of the offseason, they don't have to. They could bring him back next year, bat him third, put him in the outfield, and still just be the same old Andrew McCutchen, they would hope.
Fact is, he's the face of the franchise, and that means something. I assume that it has that he's in some way been contacted, right? I mean, in your understanding, is this a situation where they at least have reached out to Andrew McCutchen about everything that's swirling around?
That's not typically the way they go about their business in the offseason. Some players don't like to know. They don't want to hear the latest day-to-day. Yeah. You know, here's you know who we're talking to. Yeah, just let me know where I'm playing next year, and I think that's probably fair. Because otherwise, you could get eaten up by this stuff, really.
Right. Now, he's a guy that obviously had struggled early on, but he's finished strong. Good August, good September, really Andrew McCutchen-type numbers. They're confident that that's the Andrew McCutchen for 2017?
Yeah, they think that he got back to being himself a little bit more in August and September. McCutchen said he found something that worked, and he just rode that out through the rest of the year. Defensively is probably the bigger concern right now because, according to some of the advanced metrics, he was the worst defensive player in baseball last season, which is not probably the way most people think of Andrew McCutchen. Right. So, you know, while all this trade talk is going on, they're also internally evaluating whether he's best back in center field. Maybe a move to right field would be more appropriate, or potentially left field with the Gold Glove winner Starling Marte moving over into center field.
Which makes a lot of sense if he stays. If he goes, you have plenty of options, right? I would think from day one, Josh Bell's the first option there to fill in the outfield.
Yeah, that would make the most sense. Put Gregory Polanco in left field, Marte in center, and then slide back Josh Bell, the switch-hitting rookie, from first base to right field because they still have John Jaso and David Freese, that first base platoon. So they are pretty well covered right now as far as if they do move McCutchen. You know, Bell's defense is probably not going to be equivalent. He was converted to first base for a reason, but they have bodies that they could put out there. They may go out in the offseason and look for, you know, if they do trade him, a Matt Joyce type outfielder, a guy they brought in last spring training on a minor league deal, a real bounce back candidate like that. But they do have people to fill in if he is traded right now.
And you mentioned Matt Joyce, which is a great transition. Here's one guy that this team is. Obviously, he was a free agent. He has signed elsewhere. Sean Rodriguez was a free agent. He has signed elsewhere. Both guys early on signings. And that bench was a strength for this Pirates team. So that's really a key, right? To try to find those guys again isn't easy.
Yeah, I think they're going to lean mostly on their internal options. They have a lot of young guys, a couple who are out of minor league options. Alan Hansen, this is kind of a sink or swim time for him. He's been groomed as a utility type player. Jason Rogers, another corner infield type. And I think they're going to try to get the most out of their flexibility. John Jaso learned first base last year. Now he's going to try to learn third base in the outfield. David Freese can move around a little bit. And then Adam Frazier, who was sort of groomed to take over that super utility role for Rodriguez last season, he's probably that guy from the start. So they're counting on a lot of young guys, but Neil Huntington's always opportunistic. If somebody falls to them later in the offseason to fill a bench-type role, they'll definitely look for it.
The other option in the outfield, Austin Meadows, who's kind of skyrocketed through the minor league system. Obviously, he's a first-round pick, and he's lived up to that hype. When will he be ready?
I think the expectation is mid-season in 2017. He made it to AAA last year. He missed a little bit of developmental time this offseason. He had an oblique injury, couldn't go to the Arizona Fall League, but he'll start next season in AAA. The idea is that September at the latest, but probably at some point next summer, I would think. And maybe that timeline gets accelerated if Andrew McCutchen is traded. That's not how they like to handle their prospects. They believe that players are ready when they're ready, not when they have to be. Yeah. So that's something to keep an eye on, though, depending on what happens with McCutchen.
Other needs for this team, we mentioned the bench, pitching. And everybody needs pitching, but this Pirates team is an organization done such an incredible job with starters. Ray Searidge, the wizard of turning pitchers around. He wasn't able to do that with John Neese last year, which really hurt this team. When you look at this team heading into 2017, how much starting help do they need to add?
I think they need at least one proven starting pitcher, whether it's a young guy, you know, the Giolito or Joe Ross type, or they're also talking to some veteran pitchers. Somebody like Derek Holland probably fits that bounce back candidate profile. Yeah. They're meeting with his agent at some point during these meetings. So you could see them go out and add two starters, create maybe a little more of an interesting competition come spring training for that last spot. But at the very least, they need one guy behind Garrett Cole, Jameson Taillon, and in front of Chad Kuhl, maybe Tyler Glasnow, any of their young arms that they can plug in at the back of the rotation.
And one of the good things is this is a starting pitching market where maybe we saw the one front end guy, Rich Hill, already gone back to the Dodgers, but that's not what the Pirates need. They have Garrett Cole. They have Jameson Taillon. You don't have to worry about one and two, and there are options to fill out those lower spots.
Right. I think Ivan Nova would be their ideal. He was a guy who, another Ray Searidge reclamation project last season. But again, like you mentioned, this is such a thin, high-end pitching market right now that Rich Hill is off the board, people are probably going to turn their attention to Ivan Nova. He might be priced out of the Pirates market, but there's guys out there. Jason Hamill, I mentioned Derek Holland, somebody like that. There are plenty of fits out there that they can find, analyze, and see who's the best fit.
Nova's fascinating. If you're Pirates, maybe you almost wish he hadn't pitched as well as he did after he went over to Pittsburgh, because he'd be more affordable for them. As far as bullpen, team's in pretty good shape, but everybody can use a bullpen arm, right?
Yeah, they have a closer in Tony Watson, who is at least a nominal trade candidate because he has 1 year left of contractual control. They have Felipe Rivero, acquired in the Mark Melancon deal, to be kind of a setup man. A couple veterans in Juan Nicasio and Antonio Bastardo, another potential trade candidate. But what they really need is somebody in that eighth inning, ideally a veteran right-hander. There are plenty of those on the market, including the guy who filled that role last season, which was Neftali Feliz. They actually spoke to his representatives during the season about a contract extension to keep him on board. So we'll see if those talks pick back up here in the offseason.
As far as the winter meeting goes in general and Neil Huntington and company's approach, obviously we're all hearing about McCutchen and those rumors. But what's the general approach by the Pirates every year when they come to the winter meetings?
They keep all of their options open at all times. It's basically the way they feel they have to operate as a small market club with a limited payroll. They can't, you know, view themselves as being above anything. They have to consider everything. You know, you hear a lot of their guys mentioned in trade talks just because they don't really shut the door on anything. So it tends to be kind of a busy, you know, rumor-filled winter meetings for the Pirates, but it's just basically a product of where they are.
All right, great stuff. This has been MLB.com Extras from the winter meetings, talking about the Pittsburgh Pirates. For Adam Berry, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. We're talking Brewers baseball here at the winter meetings. Tim McMaster along with Adam McAlvey. And Adam, Hall of Fame vote comes out Sunday night. And Bud Selig, obviously 22-year commissioner of baseball, is headed to the Hall of Fame. But before he was the commissioner, he was the owner of the Milwaukee Brewers. And maybe more importantly, he brought the Brewers to Milwaukee.
Yep.
I know baseball thinks of him as a great commissioner. What does the city of Milwaukee think of Bud Selig?
Yeah, he is known there as the man who brought baseball back. The Milwaukee Braves, they were the first National League team to draw 2 million. They had a great following with those really good teams in the late 50s, but then left in 1965. Bud Selig was a minority owner of the team then, and he was just devastated along with a lot of the rest of the city and spent the next 5 years trying to bring a team back. And it's been interesting over the years talking to him. They had failure after failure after failure, came close many times to the point where they were announcing expansion teams and it was Montreal, you know, and his heart just sinks down. They eventually were able to get the Seattle Pilots, and because of that, there's baseball in Milwaukee. So I think he is he is known, you know, in Wisconsin as the guy who got baseball there and then kept it there with the construction of Miller Park.
And being a small market as far as the Brewers go, I think that kind of helped lead into to some of his philosophy as commissioner, because he never forgot about those small market teams when he was in charge of the league.
Yeah, and, you know, it also is just even more broadly than that. There's a love of the game there. It was his mother who first took him to baseball games at a stadium called Borchert Field that's now demolished. You know, whether you agree or disagree with the decisions he made, I think behind it was always a love of baseball. And that is the one constant in his life. It was, you know, he's a man of routine. I was talking to his wife, Sue, today about what yesterday was like before this announcement. And he went over to Gilly's Frozen Custard, a place in Milwaukee, gets a hot dog and Diet Coke almost every day. He still does that almost every day. Came home, watched the Packers on TV, and sort of sat around waiting for the call. So it was tense for him. He was nervous about this, but now it's official that he's going into the Hall.
He joined us here, and he said when he answered the call, they said he was one of the most excited people answering the phone they had ever heard, which is great from a guy who's 80 years old now, yeah. Former commissioner. Let's talk about this Brewers team now. One big signing already, Eric Thames, which is a name that I think when he gets signed, a lot of people go, who's that? Sure. Why is he getting a three-year deal? And then you see the numbers. This guy put up video game numbers in Korea, which I think a few years ago you would have thought, oh, it's Korea. But we've seen the last couple of years guys like Jung Ho Kang and other guys that hit in Korea and hit in the major leagues, kind of gives more credence to what he did.
Well, but and Gong said the challenge was velocity.
Yeah.
You know, in we talked with Eric Thames about this a little bit. In South Korea, it's 89-90, but a lot of breaking balls, a lot of pitchability with the guys. He thinks that he's a better hitter today than he was when he last saw action in the major leagues, 2012. It's been a while for him. But he is going to have to adjust now to everybody coming out of the pen throwing 97 miles an hour. And that's going to be an adjustment. And look, this is a risky move. This is not a slam dunk move. And they're parting with a first baseman in Chris Carter, who just led the league in homers. So it's a very interesting gamble that they're making. But the best way I can describe it is it comes down to this. Chris Carter had 2 years of arbitration eligibility left, probably was going to cost about $25 million for those 2 years. If the Brewers are right about Eric Thames and they exercise this option and he hits all these incentives for plate appearances, it's going to be about a little less than $25 million for 4 years.
Yeah.
Which means when you're talking about a team in a rebuild, sort of eyeing the other side of it at this point, he has a chance to be there on the other side of the rebuild if they're right about this scouting assessment. And again, it's no sure thing, but it is a very interesting move and an exercise in sort of creative scouting.
You mentioned Chris Carter, and how many guys who hit 40 home runs have been non-tendered? It seems
none.
Crazy, none, right?
Yeah.
He's the first. Were you surprised, or did you kind of see it coming?
Well, I kind of saw it coming only because of conversations that you've had. And, again, this idea of, you know, this is a team that is thinking sort of in a longer chunk of years, right. A rebuilding club. So Chris Carter had a great year for him. It's a tough pill to swallow for him. That call was not easy. And David Stearns and Chris Carter did have a conversation. Chris Carter's got to feel betrayed, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, you have a great year. You do exactly what you're supposed to do, and you get cut loose. So it is tough. It is a little unprecedented. But, again, this is a club that's trying to think a little longer term. And was Chris Carter going to be on the back end of this rebuild? The answer was probably not, and that's why they decided to make a different move.
A guy that could be on the back end of this rebuild is obviously Ryan Braun, who still has a lot of years left in a big contract with the Brewers. We've heard trade rumors before. You hear them again. Is there anything to that? How blown away would the Brewers have to be to think about trading a Ryan Braun?
Well, I mean, it becomes more realistic with each passing day.
Right.
He is going to be 33 years old. He's coming off a full healthy season, proved he came off back surgery and could still produce. Top 10 OPS in the National League. Signed for 4 years at about $19 million per, which is almost under market.
Suddenly reasonable,
You know, Yoenis Cespedes getting 27.5.
Yeah.
I'll take Ryan Braun if he's healthy. So those are all reasons, on one hand, for the Brewers to keep him and sort of anchor this rebuild, but they're also reasons to trade him because it's hard to make the argument that his value is going to go up from where it is right now. And that's the question they face. If they've made already a number of rebuilding-type moves. Last year at the winter meetings, for example, they traded Adam Lind for 3 teenage pitching prospects. They've got this long view. And, you know, this is their last really big chip to trade. I think there's a really strong argument to be made to strike while the iron is hot, strike while his value is high. The problem right now is Andrew McCutchen is out there too. Right. And you're talking about a guy that's 2 years shy of $30 million. That makes probably, you know, cuts down the Brewers' options a little bit for a guy like Braun, who's a bigger commitment and more risk.
So maybe you wait for McCutchen to go and see how it plays out from there. One of the big chips they have already traded, Jonathan Lucroy, who it seemed like for 3-4 years was in rumors. Finally at the deadline, they traded him to the Rangers. They get prospects back there, but it opens up a hole at catcher, one of their needs here this week and going forward this winter.
Yeah, you know, the Brewers' needs are interesting. They have a team they could put on the field right now.
Right.
And they've already added a ton of prospects. It would be about seeing what some of the younger guys, say like a Johnny VR, who broke through last year, what can he do in the second year in Milwaukee? But they also have options to make some deals. Catcher is one area where they could upgrade. They have Martin Maldonado, who's been a longtime backup, really good defensive catcher. They probably could find an upgrade offensively at that position. I think third base is kind of an opening for them right now, but they have guys who could play there. VR could play there, but there's some thought maybe he's better as a second baseman. Now you're open at third, maybe get another lefty bat, which is something they're looking for. In left field, obviously, would be a question if you trade Ryan Braun. So they have, on one hand, they have needs at these winter meetings. On the other hand, they don't have holes. So I think David Stearns is in kind of an interesting place that he can shop around his options, and he could have a very busy week where he makes a number of transactions, or it could be totally quiet. And I think both are equally likely this year.
You talk about the youth movement, and you start to see these guys, and I think any expert that you talk to that knows minor league systems puts the Brewers near the top of the list as far as not just top-end talent, but depth. I think it's an overall solid organization. We saw the number one prospect come up in Arcia last year, yep, and instantly show that he was ready to play at the major league level. Who's kind of the next guy in that train to the major leagues?
Well, it's hard to look past Lewis Brinson. He's an outfielder that they got in the Lucroy deal from Texas. He's right on the cusp. He finished the year at AAA, so he's on the 40-man roster now as of last month. So he's right there, and if a Ryan Braun trade happens, for example, if there's an injury next season, you could see Brinson in the major league. So I think he's the guy who's, you know, he's the number one prospect, but he's also, like, right up there at the top level. And Arcia is another guy. He's graduated from that list, but, I mean, he's got to prove he can hit in the big leagues. He can field for sure. There's no question about that. But I think this coming season is going to be a really interesting one for him to see if he can take that offensive step forward.
You think back to before the last time this team kind of built themselves into a division winner when Braun was young and Fielder was young and Lucroy, all those guys that were a part of that team were young. Are there comparisons you can draw between this minor league system right now and where this team was back before that team went and went into the postseason?
That's an interesting question. I think generally they're deeper now. I think they have a longer list of good players that they think are going to play in the major leagues. But when you think back to the early 2000 Brewers teams, the Jack Sorensic scouting teams, you know, it was Prince Fielder, it was Ricky Weeks second overall in the draft. There was some extreme high-end prospects in that. It's a little different now. I think there's maybe more depth and not as – I don't know if there's a Prince Fielder in that group right now. So we'll see. I think that David Stearns' philosophy has been quantity. Right. They've just gathered as many good young players as they can. They don't really care what position they play. They're not thinking of holes in the organization. And, you know, are there Prince Fielders in there? Are there Addison Russells, Javi Baez's? I don't know that. That time will tell. But I think you have to agree they have a lot of volume. They have a lot of players with a chance.
Great stuff. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Brewers Winter Meetings edition. For Adam McAlvey, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
We are talking Cincinnati Reds here at the Winter Meetings outside of Washington, D.C. Tim McMaster along with our MLB.com Reds reporter Mark Sheldon. And Mark, you look at this Reds team. Obviously, it's rebuild mode. It's been that way for a little bit. They've kind of, at this point, though, traded most of what they can trade as far as veterans go. And now it's time to look at these kids and take the next step. What does that mean for this week at the winter meetings for the Reds?
Well, like you said, they've done most of the removal of veterans. They do have two left, but they would like to at least explore trades. Brandon Phillips at second base, Zach Cozart at shortstop. Cozart would be a lot easier to move because he only has a year left till free agency. Phillips has a no-trade clause. He's making $14 million, and he's going to be 36 in June. A little tougher. What makes it tough for both of them is that there's really not a lot of demand out there for shortstops and second basemen right now. The Mariners trade for Gene Segura, really took away one of the big matches that could have happened for Cozart. So I think they'll spend this week maybe looking at those two guys to be moved, but if they don't have to move them, they'll hang on to them and find a way to make it work so they can get playing time for Jose Peraza, Dilson Herrera, and things like that.
Now, they thought they had a trade for Brandon Phillips a year ago, and he has the no trade. He turned it down. Is he more willing to accept a trade this time around?
He hasn't spoken publicly on it. I talked to him in September, and he was as emphatic about staying. He loves Cincinnati. He liked to be in Cincinnati. He's always been very popular, of course. But I also talked to a source during November, and I got the impression, and also I think John Morosi also talked to a source, that we both got to the same conclusion that he seems like he's more willing to maybe move on that this year. It's 1 year to go. He wants to be a winner somewhere. He had a chance to do that in Washington and didn't do it, but maybe now with what's left and knowing that he's kind of being a little bit, you know, shooed towards the door, maybe that's kind of maybe motivating him to at least explore listening on a possible trade and accepting one.
You mentioned the kids up the middle, basically, Dilson Herrera and Jose Peraza, two guys that they got from dealing away those veterans and brought into the system. Do they feel like both these guys are ready for the major leagues now, or is it, you know, if we can get them there at some point this year with a look ahead to 2018?
It's less specific on Herrera because they didn't see him in the major leagues. He only played maybe 25 games for Louisville when he came over in the Jay Bruce trade. But they did see Jose Peraza quite a bit when Cozart was hurt, when Billy Hamilton was hurt. They found a way for the last 6 weeks to really involve him in the lineup every day, and they loved what they saw. And they even at 22, believe he is everyday major league ready at a position. His best position is probably shortstop, but he could play second base. He could play left field. He could play center field. So there's opportunities for him to move around. And they've discussed that if they do have Phillips and Cozart still on the team when they open this season, and obviously Adam Duvall in left field, Billy Hamilton in center field, and Scott Shubler in right field, that they will come up with ways to mix and match and have guys move around, kind of not unlike what the Cubs did with their lineup with having Zobrist and Bryant mix around places. So I think that it'd be easier to find one spot every day, but they may have to adjust.
It's interesting with Peraza. He was with the Braves. He quickly went to the Dodgers and then to the Reds, and you almost got the feeling like, are these teams not seeing it there with him anymore? But I don't think that's the case. It just, he was the guy in the trade.
Yeah, right? He was the guy. He was a top prospect for both of those organizations, and the Reds really wanted him, and it fit and needed what they wanted. They also liked the fact that he's a good fielder, but they really liked the fact that he's just a hitter and that he puts the ball in play. He's not a guy that's going to sit around and wait to strike out. He's just going to keep swinging, and he's going to hit, and he made a lot of things happen in the short time. Him and Billy Hamilton in the top of the lineup really were a reason why they were much better in the second half than they were in the first half.
Talk about needs here this week, and you know, adding a starter would be great, but bullpen, right, really stands out for this team.
Yeah, the bullpen can only really go up from where they did last year. All the home runs they allowed. I mean, the team set a major league record in general for home runs allowed, but the bullpen led the league in home runs and walks allowed, which is really not what you want. They did find some stability with Raisel Iglesias and Michael Lorenzen, two former starters that kind of came in and gave Brian Price some options in the late innings where he could use them for one inning, he could use them for three innings, and they brought power stuff. And they had Tony Cingrani as a left-handed kind of de facto closer. He was never named the closer, but he had 17 saves, and the three of them maybe can combine and find ways to mix and match. They really are not talking about a set role guy. He doesn't think that, and Brian Price doesn't think that anybody in that team has earned a right to say, I demand this role every day. He thinks that guys have to be flexible enough to do whatever it takes, kind of look at what the Indians and the Cubs and the Dodgers did in the postseason and find a way to make that possible maybe is a little harder over, you know, a regular season schedule.
It's becoming tougher and tougher, I feel like, to add bullpen pieces just because it used to be you had to really pay your closer. Then you had to really pay your setup man. Now we're seeing with the deal Brett Cecil got and all these deals that every piece to that bullpen is getting pricier and pricier.
It is, and I mean, Melanson is a closer, and he just signed a $62 million deal with the Giants, and even the lower end of the bullpen, that's the vogue piece right now. Everyone saw what happened in the postseason. They said, wow, they brought in Andrew Miller in the fifth inning, and he's going to get paid. And I think now that's become an idea that maybe you don't have to role allocate your guys, even the closer. If you have a lot high leverage situation, your closer is in the seventh inning, fine, but you have to pay them still. And the one issue the Reds have is that they're coming into this needing bullpen help, in a year when the bullpen market's going to be really high. And they don't, even though they have more money to spend, they have a new TV contract taking effect in 18. They don't want to get into a bidding war. They're not going to, you know, get to the high end of this market for that. They may have to wait after the meetings, after the holidays, and then see what's left in January, and maybe they can get a lower price. So I don't rule them out getting anything done here, but I have a feeling it's going to be later in the offseason.
You talk about them wanting to trade Phillips and Cozart, but other teams would love them to trade Billy Hamilton to them. That's a different question because he's a guy that obviously can fit into the future as well. How is Dick Williams kind of handling that when one of your players who's still very young is getting those big offers where maybe you have the opportunity, but maybe it's not in your best interest?
Well, I don't know if the offers are big yet. I think he's listening, and I know he's listening, and he's listening on other players that maybe they wouldn't plan on trading, but I think he wouldn't be doing his job if he didn't at least hear what they had to say. It doesn't mean they're shopping him. There's a huge difference between listening and shopping, and I think it would take a lot for the Reds to give up Billy Hamilton. He's got arbitration eligible for the first time, so he's got 3 years of club control. If they want to win by 2018 and at least start contending, I think they feel like he's part of that process and he needs to win, needs to be in the lineup as a leadoff hitter. But if they get blown away by an offer, they may have to really take a hard look at it. I mean, the one thing they do value from him, maybe above everything else, is his defense. And he was so good defensively last year. He's definitely a Gold Glove consideration, finalist, deserving. But he saves so many runs defensively that they may value that too much to make a move for him.
When you look at guys they could trade, one that coming into the winter meetings you heard a lot about was Joey Votto, despite the team saying they had no interest in trading Joey Votto. And Joey Votto now has actually said, you can't trade me. Obviously, I have a no-trade clause, and he would not accept waiving that no-trade clause. But it's still something the team has to deal with. It's just got to be frustrating, right, for an organization to have to hear all these rumors, knowing that, hey, this isn't something that's going to happen. Do you think they should at least be listening?
Again, they should listen for everything.
Right.
But I would say, the national media and a lot of people are, always saying that the small market team like the Reds, high contract like Votto, the way he produces, they need to get rid of him so they can continue to field the team.
Right.
Well, they don't want to do that. They've said there've been no negotiations at all to get Votto this year. I know the Blue Jays a couple of years ago, their previous regime and Walt Jocketty had apparently preliminary talks, but they never went anywhere. And he doesn't want to be traded. He said last year and just this week, I don't want to be traded. He's like, I'm happy here. I don't want to make a stink. I'm never going to ask for a trade unless I feel the broom trying to sweep me out, kind of like what it happened to Chase Utley in Philadelphia or Brandon Phillips now with the Reds. Then he might change his tune a little bit, but as long as he's producing and as long as he's happy in Cincinnati, he doesn't want to leave. And, I expect every offseason we're going to hear these questions, but it doesn't bother the Reds, I think. It's just they and Joey Votto are not buying into the narrative that he has to be traded.
All right, great stuff as always. This has been MLB.com Extras from the winter meetings. For Mark Sheldon, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Talking Chicago Cubs baseball here at the winter meetings, Tim McMaster along with our MLB.com Cubs reporter, Kerry Muscat. And it's a whole new world here at the winter meetings for the Cubs. For the first time, they come here as the defending champs. They didn't have a lot to get done, but they got it done. This team needed to add a closer, and that's what they've done. They go out, they do it via the trade. They didn't spend a ton of money to bring back Aroldis Chapman. Instead, it's Wade Davis. Is there any concern health-wise about Wade Davis, or are they just excited to have a guy that has proven in the last year and a half that he can be a front-line closer?
Yeah. I think the best part of this deal was that the Royals encouraged the Cubs to have their own athletic trainer go and check on him physically. Hands-on, so to speak. And so what they did was they flew their trainer from Chicago to New York before finalizing the deal so that he could actually see Davis, could actually check out his arm. Davis was on the DL twice in 2016 because of a right forearm strain. So this way they could actually do their own, you feel a lot more comfortable about making a deal if you get to look at the guy and look him in the eye and check him out. And I think that all the medicals checked out. Physically, he checked out, and they decided to go ahead with the deal. I don't know if they could have gone into the season in 2017 with Hector Rondon, but I just think Aroldis Chapman made such a difference in 2016 to get them to the World Series. They don't win without Chapman. So I just think that's now in their mindset how much they need to have that guy. And so they're hoping Wade Davis is that guy.
Yeah, he certainly has been with the Royals. And it did take a while for this to become finalized, which now makes sense when you mention that. Right. How rare is that for a team before a trade like this to allow the other team's doctors to...
The general manager, Jed Hoyer, said it is rare because obviously you can't really do that in season. You don't have the luxury of time. So they had the luxury of time being the off season, so that's why they were able to go and do this. So I think it's fairly rare. I would think maybe in the off season teams can pull it off, but the Cubs kind of like to, like I say, look guys in the eye. The other thing with Wade Davis is Joe Maddon and bench coach Dave Martinez know him because they were together in Tampa Bay, so they both talked to Davis and they had a feel. Could get a feel for him and feel how healthy he is.
And he knows he'll fit into that clubhouse, sure, as well, which is huge. Now, Jorge Soler goes the other way. Obviously, he was one of the first kind of young guys to come up, but then he almost just got passed by some of the other young talent in this Cubs organization. And at the end of the day, in the numbers game, it just didn't seem like it was ever going to work out in Chicago.
There just wasn't a spot for Soler. And I know Hoyer said it was really difficult to trade him since he was one of the first kind of building blocks that they had in terms of their rebuild. Soler is more comfortable in right field. The Royals are projecting him in right field, which will be good for him. Also, he can DH, which will be good for him. You know, his career's been slowed because of various leg injuries that have just been little nagging things. It's nothing major. It's just always little nagging things. So I think... kind of the cool thing is Soler actually tweeted out a video of him working out. So I think he was kind of showing that he's ready to go for the season. I think this is a great move for him. It should give him more playing time. You know, the Cubs have Schwarber, they have Zobrist with the addition of John Jay. They've got him, Almora, Hayward. They've got a pretty loaded outfielder. They've got some young outfielders in the system. I just think it's a great move for Soler. I'm going to be sorry to see him go, though. He's a key part of that clubhouse.
We've seen the Cubs hang on as long as they can to kind of all of these young guys, and they've all come up, obviously, and started to contribute. You knew eventually there would be just no spaces for guys, and there's going to be other prospects that probably face. You talk about Ian Happ and these other guys, but this is why you have prospects, not just to have them come help you win a World Series like a lot of these guys have, but to bring in those other key pieces.
Well, and that's exactly true. I mean, look at how they had to part with Gleyber Torres last year just to get Chapman.
Right.
You know, so it does show that this is sort of the importance of their minor league system. The Cubs organization was named Baseball America's top organization of the year, without a doubt. And the kids have a part. I know some of the kids get frustrated when they don't have playing time, and I think the players are always told, remember, you're not just playing for the Cubs, you're playing for the other 29 teams, you know, because here's the perfect situation. Soler may not have gotten as many at-bats as he wanted with the Cubs, but he now can see that, you know, another team really wanted him, and that's a good thing for him.
And there was certainly no room for error in the 2016 World Series, that's for sure. John Jay coming in, he's a veteran guy. He's been on winners, obviously, with the Cardinals and consistent winners in that division. He knows the division. What does he bring? Where does he fit into that outfield, which without Dexter Fowler is suddenly interesting just as far as who fits where with Jason Hayward and Kyle Schwarber and Ben Zobrist? Where does it all fit together?
I don't think they've decided if Jay would take over for Fowler as the leadoff man. I'm not sure that the lineup has been quite figured out, but I think the main goal with John Jay is to have him sort of tutor Albert Almora Jr. Almora is an incredible defensive player, and he also knows Jay. They're both Miami guys, so just having that dynamic is going to be just super for Almora in terms of his development. I think a lot of us that have been think that Almora's been around forever and forget that he was drafted out of high school. And it just takes time, you know, for him to develop. But I think that'll be a really good match, similar to, you know, Miguel Montero kind of mentoring Wilson Contreras in terms of the catcher situation.
It seems like it's four guys for three spots to a degree. Is that something that just gets figured out in spring training?
For center?
No, for the outfield in general, with Hayward and Jay and Zobrist and Schwarber.
And Schwarber, I think it just kind of gets sorted out. I know they would like to have, Madden wants to sort of not overwork Zobrist, if that makes sense. I mean, he's not 20.
Right.
You know, and I know that Ben, and if Ben is watching this, I apologize. I know Ben's in great shape, but and he works so hard at it. But I also know that they will probably, one of the things that I think the Cubs really showed last year was their versatility. And they showed just how, you know, you can have Zobrist everywhere. You can put Bryant wherever you want. You can put Travis Wood, the reliever, out in left field. And that all worked. I just think that they're going to try and take advantage of that versatility and move guys around, and everybody will get their at-bats.
How about the leadership factor as far as Jay goes? Because this team loses David Ross, and there's nobody better in the clubhouse. And I think Jed Hoyer mentioned with Jay that, hey, he's going to replace some of that.
I think they're looking for John Jay to fill that void. They're also, fingers crossed, hoping that David Ross will come back to the team in some kind of role, more like a special assistant to the general manager, but he would be around, and he would still be there for some of the young players who need that sort of mentorship. And I also think that guys like Anthony Rizzo they're ready to take that next step. They learn from David. They learn from Rossi. And then look at, I mean, the guy that blew us away in the playoffs in Game 7 was Jason Hayward, who called the team meeting during the rain delay. And I know for us as reporters, you know, Jason's very, very thoughtful man, very quiet. But the fact that he initiated that and he's the one who got the team together, I think that's just a huge, it'll just have a huge role in terms of next year for him.
This has been MLB.com Extras, our Cubs Winter Meetings edition. For Kerry Muscat, I'm Tim McMaster. Thanks for tuning in.
MLB.TV Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.TV Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go. Every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details.